Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers.
Woo!
Yeah, look at that, huh?
I like that.
Yeah, fancy stuff. Well, hello, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good whatever time it is, wherever you are. I am Malcolm. I'm the host of the CDO Matters podcast, and we are both, Samir and I are both impressed with our new recording platform. Higher quality audio, higher
quality. It's not ours, it's yours.
Yeah, it's mine, but you're here today, so it is ours.
Today, okay, it's ours today.
It's ours today.
Yeah.
Cheers. As you can tell, I am joined by my friend, Mr. Samir Sharma, who is the CEO of DataZoom, a boutique consultancy focused on data strategy, data and analytics, all things data. If you need a super smart consultant who is focused on business outcomes, look no farther than my friend Samir. We're going to talk today about all sorts of things, data and analytics. We have no set agenda. We did this a few weeks ago on your podcast.
A couple of weeks ago.
By the way, the Data Strategy Show. So check out the Data Strategy Show if you have not already.
I'll just sit back and you just big me up.
I'm
happy with that. And I, by the way, disclaimer, I haven't paid him for anything.
Yeah, not yet. Not yet.
I'll buy you a pint when I'm in Florida.
Brilliant. He did, it wasn't the last time we were together, but one of the first time we ever met, Samir took me to a flower show.
So, well, you were in London and it was the Chelsea Flower Show and we met in Sloane Square and that
lovely.
Is just around the corner from the Chelsea Flower Show. And I think
it's factually true to say that we went to a flower show.
Well, we didn't go to the flower show. It's factually true to say that we walked around and saw the flower sculptures.
Yes.
That were sprawled around the King's Road area.
I'm still going to say that we went to a flower show on our first date. On our first mandate. Yes. Our first mate date, as it were. Yes. So Samir and I met on LinkedIn, as so many do these days online.
Yes, absolutely. It's an old line now, isn't it? We met on LinkedIn.
Yeah. And we share a lot of perspectives in common. Obviously, found a rapport. And the Sloane Square meeting was just, hey, let's meet up for coffee. I think I was there for,
You were there for work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was the IRM conference last year. Maybe
it wasn't. You were in London Bridge for something.
Yeah.
And you said, I'm going to come over to Sloane Square. And I said, great, I'll meet you at whatever time. And I think it was that. Anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So today's episode is just about advertising some of your services, his consulting services, his genius.
Let me get the 350-page deck up so I can present.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, there will be a deck later about the importance of data strategy and operating
absolutely.
Models.
Absolutely. So get your pillows.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. Happy 2025. This will air, I think, probably the first week of February. So it probably
You can't say
happy 2025 anymore.
I thought we were actually live on LinkedIn. Oh, I see.
We're recording. So,
okay.
You know,
no, I know we're recording.
If either of us says anything really dumb, we could edit it out if we had to, but no, we're not live. We are recorded. Okay. I'm just checking my date. Oh, this will air on February 6th. So, Yes. Just a few days after Groundhog Day here in the United States, which one of our bigger...
Which is what day?
It's usually February 1st, is it not? Or February 2nd?
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Is that first or second? I should know Groundhog Day. I was just being glib, saying it's one of our more important holidays here in the U.S. How these things get established, I'll never know. But Groundhog Day, however...
Isn't that a movie?
Well, it was a movie. It was a brilliant movie.
It's a great movie. Yeah.
Arguably, one of Bill Murray's best movies.
Yes, I would argue. Absolutely.
I love the comedy there. He was good at that. Next week, though, everybody, get ready. Valentine's Day. If this is your reminder,
is it next week?
It will be the next week. It'll be the 14th, February 14th.
Right, airing the 6th.
A time capsule.
So you're now. Yes, we are. Yeah,
we're in a time capsule.
We're time traveling right now.
Yes. Now that assumes that people could be listening to this in the year 2030, right? Because we do these we stick them on the YouTubes and the interwebs and the winterwebs, and who knows when people consume it. But if they're consuming it, like most of my subscribers and listeners do when it first comes out, next week will be Valentine's Day. So don't forget Valentine. Keep your Valentine near and dear. You doing anything for Valentine's? Is that like a thing in the UK? Valentine's is a thing in the UK, of course.
Well, of course it is. It's a hallmark thing everywhere in the world, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's just yes, I don't know. I actually, when this airs on the day of the 6th, I will actually be in the US.
Oh, really? Where are you coming?
Yeah, I'll be in Chicago.
What are you doing in Chicago, if I may ask?
Oh, I am working with a new client in Chicago.
Oh, that's fantastic. One of my favorite cities. I really love Chicago.
I like it too.
Except in the winter.
In the winter. I know, it's brutal. I did check the weather and yesterday it was minus 18. And I just thought, okay, holy.
So that's minus 18 Celsius. So that's legit cold. That's pretty cold.
Yeah. When I get there, I think it's going to be about minus 7, minus 5 or something like that. Still cold.
You'd be lucky. Well, the biggest challenge with Chicago is not the fact that it could be sub-zero or sub-freezing, is the wind. So walking around, the wind comes off the lake and it gets funneled between all of those buildings. And it could be chilly. But minus 18, that Fahrenheit, that's zero in Fahrenheit. Minus 18 is zero. Because I'm constantly converting in my head. Because I grew up in Canada. We were always metric. And then now that I've been in the U.S. for so long, I'm constantly converting. And it's like, what's that? And you know.
And you had a big event there yesterday in the U.S.
Yes, we did.
Massive event.
We inaugurated the 47th president of the United States, John Donald J. Trump. And the republic still stands. Everything's still here.
It does.
Everything's on.
It's still working.
It's still working.
You didn't fall off the map yet.
Not yet. We'll see. But we're only so far. This was obviously this is January 21st. Yesterday was the inauguration. So
and he's halfway through his early morning, I guess, or sort of into the afternoon already. He's not.
It's just after 10 here. So
So it's about 11-ish there.
Yeah. So everything is just fine. Everything will be fine. The Republic will stand. I'm looking forward to this is a good segue. I'm looking forward to a big 2025. I'm a little less, you know, in my annual predictions episode, which will have come out. It comes out this week, actually, in a couple of days.
Okay.
I'd love your perspective on this, Amir. Particularly the European perspective. I think it's going to be a better year in 2025. I think
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a better year. What do you think from the European perspective? Like just kind of macroeconomically, where do you see things headed?
Well, look, I think 24 was a dog of a year, to be honest, in Europe. It wasn't the best. And I've certainly seen a slight upswing in things, but I think there's still a lot of stuff that's happening in the UK and Europe. That still needs to be resolved. You know, economic headwinds have not disappeared. And they're not the positive headwinds right now as we were hoping. Although we've had a little bit of a bump here in the UK. I think the difference is, you know, from my perspective, when I look at, and I have a number of US clients. So when I look at the US, I always find that in the US, everybody's a little bit, that their step is a little bit different than the UK and Europe, and Europe, and you know, particularly because I've had some European clients last year as well, where I think they're not willing to embrace the innovation or go full steam into something and really you know, claim it and put their arms around it and say, we're actually going to do this. There's a lot of political natured machinations that go into decision making. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe decision making is, you know, from my perspective in the US, is to me is sometimes a little bit quicker. People are more willing to do stuff, jump into it, test and, you know, learn. Whereas I think, you know, in the UK and more so in Europe, they're a bit reticent. They're sort of a little bit, you know, standing behind the service line and thinking, do I serve yet or not? Do I kind of get into it? Should I do a really hard first service or should I just take it easy and see where it goes? So it's, you know, I'm hoping that 25 will be a better year in the UK. But economically, we haven't started brilliantly. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. What you just said completely explains the things that I've witnessed in my professional career. Mm. And I've never really been able to articulate why, which is what I've seen in the data and analytics space over the last 20 years is about a 2 to 3 year lag.
Yes.
From
yes.
Europe and the US. And I never really tried to understand why, but I think what you just said would fully explain why. If there's a greater sense of conservatism,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If there's a greater sense maybe of a premium on collaboration versus or consensus. Maybe that's a better word to say.
It's the consensus piece, which I think is probably the better word to use. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. If there's more of a premium on consensus and getting alignment on direction than risk taking, perhaps. Yeah. If that is true, what you just said, that would explain, hey, we'll let the folks over the pond take the hit, take the risk, maybe have a few things blow up, and we'll learn from that.
Correct.
On the European side of the globe, that would fully explain it and completely rational, by the way. Interesting.
Yeah. 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 And that's my observation. That's the way that I've seen it develop over the years that I've been in business. And certainly when I started off, it was very much a UK based, you know, we had UK based clients. But as we started to grow, we've got more clients in the US. And, you know, I see a complete difference in the openness and the accessibility to people and more willing to view, you know, as you said it, risk taking, you know, let's see what it might look like. Let's try it. Let's attempt it. Whereas, you know, there's a sort of not a backward approach, but, you know, it's a sort of back step, you know, let's step back and look at everything first before we kind of, you know, take that in. Oh, you know, that's that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe in very large global global organizations, you know, even in the US, maybe there is still a very high nature of that consensus driven decision making, but certainly with the organizations I work with in the US, that there seems to be a little bit more of maybe urgency, you know, urgency. Yeah. and a growth mentality and a willingness for success, which is often needed, you know, in these kinds of initiatives, you know. And I'm not saying that in the UK and Europe there isn't. I think it's sort of, there's always a question about it. There's always something, you know, that sits in the back of my head is, you know, is it really being done for the impact and the growth and the efficiencies, or is it really being done because you want to look good, you know? And you know, okay. So there's that. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, and look, not to say that doesn't happen in the US, of course it does, it happens everywhere, but I've just noticed a very different take on it. In it's more, I don't want to say it's more vanity, but that there is more of a I've used that word now, so I should own it. It's more vanity based than,
right,
you know, probably rambling a bit here as well, but it's kind of, well, you know, that's what I've seen.
Well, and I experienced. Think I mean, we're all human, so I think that plays. But to touch on a few of the things that you talked about, from the risk taking perspective, I think generally, if we're going to generalize, mm-hmm. I think that's large to what you just said is a little bit true from the perspective of companies in the US being a little more willing to be a little more kind of risk tolerant. I've in the data world, I've certainly seen an evolution over the last few years where companies see the even extremely big companies, like I'll take a Microsoft, for example, is seeing the benefit of taking more arguably federated approaches, right? Where there's more freedom at a business line or business level, or we could just say functional level, to make decisions. That's being articulated into more flexible operating models, more say federated operating models, federated approaches to governance. Where those business, even for the bigger companies, where they are giving a little more freedom, because I think, you know, these extremely large companies, whether you're a bank or whether you're a healthcare provider, and maybe you're even in tech like a Microsoft, they see the, you know, the Teslas of the world and the Netflixes of the world and the Amazons of the world and are in the Ubers of the world and these digital natives that are moving faster, right? That are moving a lot faster. And these big companies are saying, okay, how do we do that? And I think the response for a lot of them is to become a little more federated and a little more, you know, pushing a lot of capabilities and a lot of decision-making and a lot of authority into more functional units. Now, the trade-off for that in the world that I live in is arguably inefficiency.
Right. Yes.
Is that, do you agree?
Initially, there'll be some. Initially, so what you've just said there is quite interesting for me, because I think there is a level of there is levels of regulation across the pond with you, which are probably not as stringent as they are in Europe, right? So where we ruminate on AI and, you know, and the EU AI Act and how everything needs to be transparent, and absolutely I agree there needs to be transparency. Whereas there is a huge amount of regulation here, even in different industries, you know, you have to comply with many different levels of regulation. Not saying that the US doesn't, but when I look at it, it seems like it's less strapped in terms of regulation for innovation, for trying it and doing it and seeing if it works, and less so. And I think you can see that when you look at startups fundamentally, you know, in the US versus the startup culture in Europe. Yes, of course we have startups, but you know, we've got Revolut, which is probably the biggest fintech now in Europe, and you know, it's becoming a worldwide name. But that's one. You know, can we say that Europe has got, you know, the big startups or the big names that the US has produced? And I think there's a feeling that regulation weighs on the Europeans more than it does on the Americans. And certainly now with your new incoming president, that regulation is probably going to be lifted. You know, even it's going to be even lighter. So we'll probably see more, you know, innovation quick, and also we'll see more failures quick. Whereas in the UK and Europe, you know, we see very few of the innovative companies coming out of Europe that are going to strike that balance of, hey, you guys had 300 new startups and, you know, five of them are unicorns. Well, we had, you know, 50 and, well, not 50, but we had 500 and maybe one was a unicorn, whatever this, you know, it is. But, you know, it's, we produce less, I think, in terms of the impact on the globe. Maybe, right? This is what I'm seeing. You see it on LinkedIn as well. You see the comparisons. So, I think there is a contentious view around regulation and whether we need to have more, which it seems like we're going to have more in Europe and you're going to have less in the US. Maybe it's an assumption. I don't know.
I think that's a safe assumption based on rhetoric. Yeah. But what you have in the US is interesting. This is certainly much less so in Canada, but in the US, you have a lot of authority at a state level here.
Where of course you do. Yes.
If you take a state like California that has, you know, passed a lot of regulations over the last few years, companies are picking up and moving the Texas
and leaving.
And they're moving to Florida. They're going to more what arguably business friendly states. You know, a lot of companies have moved to Texas where I previously lived, and a lot of them are moving to Florida where I live now. So that's certainly the case. But to the point about European regulation, you know, without any sort of kind of political, whether that's you agree or whether you disagree, I think what you're saying is just a cold hard reality. It is true. Mm-hmm. There's far more regulation there. If you want to do, you know, you could argue, well, okay, because of Brexit, you know, Britain could do what it wants. But if you want to sell into the EU, right? If you want to be able to sell anything in Ireland, right? Or anywhere in France, if you're in Britain, you've got to comply with those rules. So it's
easy. Yeah,
I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say, okay, well, Britain has the flexibility to do whatever it wants. If you want to be able to have access to those markets, you've got to play by the EU rules. So I think you're right. I don't see that changing. But do you see just, is there any sort of, and this does get a little bit into politics, do you see any sort of winds kind of blowing the other way? Are people getting to the point where it's like, hey, you know, we won't be able to compete, or this is a competitive hindrance on us? Do you hear any of that over there from a just kind of a vox populi perspective? Wow, I just used that phrase out loud.
Oh, yes, you did. I have probably heard it more on platforms like LinkedIn than I have anywhere else. I think there is that sentiment, there is that feeling. Unfortunately, I'm not in the political realm, so I don't really, you know, sit with those individuals who are looking at those challenges, and you know, trying to think, how do we start? I mean, okay, you know, we've had Brexit, we've broken away from the EU. We will have our own UK, you know, AI Act. We're going to start. The Prime Minister unleashed his new AI, you know, AI strategy last week, where we are going to have a lot more of a view on, you know, how will AI help in the next 10, 15, 20 X amount of years, right? I think that's obviously a good thing. There's going to be more opportunities. But we need a base. We need to have that structure implemented. We need to have those policies enacted, etc. Whereas I think with the EU AI Act, if you are thinking about, you know, engaging and working with the EU, it may well be constrained for us. So we have to have we have to be able to look at the EU AI Act and have some way of working within that sort of context, but being able to accelerate our efforts around AI and not being constrained by it. And I think that's the reason why we came out. It's one of the reasons we came out. It's not the main reason. You know, I'm not going to go there anyway. It's too big a conversation for this.
Oh, for sure. But, well, yeah, I think there's something interesting there, Samir, which is if you assume that the regulations are just a given, right? Whether mm-hmm. From any mm-hmm. perspective, whether it's AI, whether it's sustainability, ESG, you name it, if you just assume that they're probably going to be there, and I don't see that changing anytime soon in the EU. Is there an opportunity in this? I fully expect the answer to be yes, by the way. This is a little bit of a rhetorical question, so I won't frame it in a question. I'll just say, I think there could be interesting opportunities for data leaders to innovate around the regulation, right? I'll give you an example. Right. I'll give you an example. So one of the things that I talked about in my 2025 predictions is that what I said was the US is going to regulate less and Europe will probably mm-hmm. regulate more. One of the examples that I gave is this thing called the Digital Product Passport. It's an EU mm-hmm. initiative that is designed around sustainability, but where you are increasingly going to be required to have these QR codes and products to that are designed for sustainability, to show the materials that were used in the sourcing of those products and to be able to track that product through its life cycle.
Okay, so it's lineage where it came from. And, yeah.
But it's product, well,
Yeah.
Could you innovate around that? I think you could.
So you're saying, for example, where, you know, I fished for that fish and it came from this sea and it then came up on this fisherman's plate and then it went to that particular. So you get to see everything that happened along that chain of events. And you know from source to table exactly where it, you know, interesting enough, lots of people have tried to do this previously. But again, mm-hmm. you know, there's lots of integration challenges. There's lots of data challenges because, you know, again, are we absolutely sure that that's where that particular fish came from? And is there the data to prove it? And I guess this then leads us to things like blockchain and so on. can we create, you know, all of those systems in place to ensure that we've got that footprint? Now, we can, right? I mean, it's, I think it was the, I'm just going to try and remember their name, the Marine Conversion Society or Marine, it's the MCS anyway. They're an organization here. Can't remember their name. I know it's MCS, but Marine something something. They basically tried to implement this, I think, way back in 2015, 16. They were talking, implemented. They were talking about it then. We want to have the ability to have standards and that we know where the, where, from source to table, from source to supermarket or whatever it will be, we can put our label on this to say this was fished in a, what's the word? My brain's gone blank.
Sustainable way.
Sustainable way.
Yeah. Yes, sustainable way.
Exactly. Sorry. Sustainability is such a, everybody uses it. Couldn't remember it for a moment. They tried to do that. Now, I'm sure they've got to a certain point, but can they clearly say that they've got the wrapper around it for data? Probably not. You know, because I think there's a lot of breaks in the chain.
You may be talking about something. You may be talking about something called Trade Lens, or maybe not. It was a partnership with Maersk, the shipping company Maersk, and IBM, where they tried to implement blockchain to track shipping containers, literally just to be able to track shipping containers.
Yes. Yes.
Pardon me. And they tried for years to make it work.
Is this the RFID and stuff like that?
Yes. Yeah.
I remember reading about it.
It was RFID, but it was underneath it all was a blockchain. I forget which of the chains. Doesn't matter. And they just sunset that initiative last year. They gave up on it because everything we're just talking about, Samir, requires network effects. It requires everybody to participate to a certain degree.
Yes, and at a certain level.
But when you regulate the participation, as is happening with these digital product passports, well, then you have to. But I think there could still be something interesting there. I'll give you an example. You know, in the US, and I don't know if there's a UK equivalent. Maybe there is. In the US, the Whole Foods market, for example, it charges a premium, right? If you go there and an apple at Whole Foods will cost $1 and an apple somewhere else will cost 60 cents. But when you buy that Whole Foods apple, or better example maybe is chicken, like their protein, where Whole Foods actually controls the supply chain, right? Where Whole Foods is the one that's providing the feed to the chicken farmer,
right?
Because the feed was ethically sourced and is non-GMO and is all these things. And people are willing to pay the premium to know that their chicken was fed this non-GMO food. So I see an opportunity for data leaders to maybe think about ways to innovate around some of these regulations and maybe even use them as a lever for competitive differentiation. Because I think for some consumers, not for all, but I want to know if the person who picked this coffee bean lives a good life. Maybe that's a little lofty, and maybe that's, you know,
maybe that's just you,
naive. I don't know.
While you're there sipping your latte, you know, overlooking the ocean.
I am sipping my coffee this morning, and I don't know who picked it.
You've paid over the odds for it as well, no doubt.
We try to be. To be, you know, conscious about where our food comes and what we're putting.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yeah. We have. I don't think we're too far off the path.
We're not. Yeah. But I think it's back to this digital product, you know, ID or whatever it's being called. So, and I don't know about that. So that's something interesting for me. But it's not anything new, really, though, is it?
Agreed.
It is a way for tracking. It's a way for understanding. You know, lineage. It's a way for us to as you said, to be aware of how things are produced and how things are shipped and how things are consumed. So I think that's essentially, can data leaders, yes, of course they can benefit from it. They can use it. Again, everybody gets around regulations at some point, or not around it, but, you know, innovatively using it to their advantage. Yes, of course, I think people will. There's no reason, you know. Everybody who gets frustrated about a process or a position they're in will always try and find a different route. And I think that's quite normal. So yes, to your point, I think people will find different routes. Yes, regulation will be there, but they will have to either play within it and sit within those bounds or try and find another way to do something which will help them either be more competitive or, you know, be more innovative and capture more customers or capture niche customers. However it might be, I don't have the answer, but I think people will always naturally try and get around, especially if they've got that entrepreneurial mind. You know, for them to have that sort of different mindset, as opposed to, you know, just I need breakthrough, I need difference, I need to please my customer, I need to produce something new, whereas I need to stay in the confines of what we need to do, and we can't go out of those, you know, those guardrails, and simply we, you know, it won't work. So I think there's always going to be those two kinds of mindsets, and I guess that's, you know, the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my advice to data leaders is, for a long time, you know, particularly if you are in the business of making or selling things, which we all are to some degree, you know, the premium, I would argue, has been kind of on the demand side and understanding some of the complexities on the demand side. What do our customers want? What do our customers look like? What does a customer household look like? And that's great. Mm-hmm. And I think we've made a lot of progress there to kind of understanding influences of customer behavior, but mm-hmm. I think that there's a massive mm-hmm. opportunity to be focused more on the supply side mm-hmm. and understand, where is this stuff coming from? Where do we get our stuff from? And more of a focus on arguably what best be described as product master data management, but also materials. Where are these things coming from? Are they being sourced ethically? Are they being created using renewable energy sources? All of that kind of thing. Not happening right now. And I think you're right, Samir. I think this year in the US, we'll see kind of a pullback from that. But I do think that you could do both. But
hasn't ESG been a big driver of that as well? Hasn't this whole undertone of ESG, which is probably people are pulling back on because they found it's some of it is not scalable or not doable because they don't have the data. Isn't that where we were heading with ESG?
I think it is, but I think for whatever pullback we've got, I think the perceived costs far outweighed the perceived benefits, right? Mm-hmm. And this is true with any large-scale environmental initiative, right? Because what you're doing arguably is for the future, your future self, mm-hmm. and not for your current self.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
what you are doing is an investment in changing something now for a future benefit, which means we're going to make the planet better for our kids. And that's
or move to Mars.
Maybe. I've heard it's awfully hot up there. The days are very long.
I just put water in my mouth and I thought I shouldn't have done that then, should I?
I don't know. I don't know, man. I don't think I want to live on Mars, but
I don't know.
But I was gonna say
keep watching
something
The Martian.
Real.
You know, yeah, anyway.
It is. You know, I think there's an economic theory there. There's a name of that, which is, you know, like there's this kind of game theory playing out, which is, okay, if the benefits are in the future, I actually did a undergraduate thesis on this mm-hmm. related to gambling and credit and the use of credit. And, you know, I can get something today, but where it's the inverse, where I get immediate benefits and the costs mm-hmm. are pushed into the future.
Right,
which kind of drives what this idea of game theory, and I can kind of game, but if you invert it, where all the costs are today, and the future benefits are in the future, that's a hard pill to swallow, and I think that's kind of the story of ESG. However, my point is that if you can pull some of those benefits and make them real now, which is keeping customers happier or giving them insights into, you know, data related to the products they buy, maybe they would be willing to pay. Because I think some customers would.
Right. So I think there's a couple of things there. One is the cost of living has gone up hugely.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Cost of products have gone up hugely. So now you're gonna put something on top of that, which is gonna then put your margins, you know, the margins up more for those specific products. Are people gonna be happy with that? You know, given that they are being squeezed?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
And then are organizations willing to invest that amount of cash in order for, you know, them to keep the prices as they were? I don't know. I mean, look, I'm just trying to think about where, you know, of course we all want to know, was that thing ethically sourced? Did I get did I make sure that no one died in this situation? Did I make sure that no one, you know, that people got remunerated with the right amount of, you know, money that they should be, and they're living a sustainable life and they're living a good life, as you said. I think we've come to the crux of, you know, there's lots of people who want to be more individualistic than they want to be more worldly. You know, that's where, yeah, I feel that things are going back to. You know, people want to look out for themselves rather than, you know, protect this thing that we've got around us. Right. Maybe there is some of that, you know. It's been a hard year. It's been a tough few years since COVID, you know, and people have been in very, very bad situations. And I think, you know, you've seen more of the divide, you know, that sort of, you know, wealth divide. So yeah, it's all great. It's all wonderful, but you're going to make that divide much bigger. And back to your point, you know, are you going to help society or are you going to make it worse? It's just, you know, it's just the kind of things that you need, you know, that I think about in those situations of.
I hear you. I have a dream.
Yeah.
And maybe I shouldn't be saying this on January 21st.
Well, it was yesterday. Yesterday was
MLK Day.
Martin Luther. Yeah, it was. Yeah,
and my goodness, I'm not trying to draw any sort of analogs whatsoever. But I do have this dream, and maybe it's Pollyannish, maybe it's overly optimistic, where from a data management and governance perspective, we are actually able to go beyond the minimum required to keep the regulators happy.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the way to do that is through exposing value. I mean, that's just it. Right. And
well, we agree on that always.
We absolutely do. And if we can't show the value, well, then whether it's an ESG initiative, which I think that's kind of fallen prey, right? Because you don't see the immediate value, right? The benefits are going to be delayed. So it's awfully hard, to your point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
it's very expensive.
Yes. Yeah. And I get it. Right. And there's a lot of interesting kind of, you know, global geopolitical things at play here in terms of where we are in the West versus everybody else in more developing nations. And I don't want to go into that.
Yeah.
Mess.
Let's not do that. Yeah. Yeah.
But to me, the story here is can you show value somehow, some way in anything related to what you're doing in data management, data governance?
Yeah.
And ultimately that's it. Whether it's ESG, whether it's your governance program, whether it's paying for a data steward, whether it's anything, you've got to be able to show the value. And I think that's what we'll see more of in 2025, particularly in the US, which is, if it can't justify itself, right? If there's no business case here for this government program, for this government department, if you can't justify it, well, then you could be on the chopping block.
Yeah.
Whether that goes from the government space and gets kind of filters down into the corporate space, arguably it should have always been there from the corporate perspective.
What it should think? Have, yeah. But look, I agree with you. And I think it's not to say that government is there and spending, yes, they spend a lot. But whenever I've worked in or with government, they have also been squeezed. There's the business cases that you know I've had to put together with my colleagues in those situations have been very specific. It cannot just be we're going to go out and, you know, do this initiative and it's not going to have any payback. Maybe many moons ago before I was, you know, born, but in the days that I've worked, and that was what, you know, I worked in government from 2005, albeit they were my clients, but I was working with them and then actually in government. So from 2005 until about 2009, 10. So the 2 years I spent in government, in the Caribbean, which, you know, again, you are having to prove what the policies are, what the spend is, you know, how much it's going to give back to the citizens, etc. So it's not to say that you don't have that. And it's not really, it's actually in some ways, I sometimes think that it's even more robust. There's even more pressure to get it, you know, into a really good business case that has, you tick the boxes for all those things and you make sure that you can justify it. Whereas in the corporate, I've not seen that as much, especially in data initiatives. I've seen that kind of like, you know, oh, we're going to spin up some data platform. We need a business case behind this. You know, we need to know what payback we're going to get. We need to know what we're going to build from it. We need to know how that's going to affect our, you know, is it going to affect our revenue or is it going to be an efficiency program or whatever it might be. But, you know, how is it going to help our customers? I see very little of that.
That's interesting.
Whereas you and I know that's the first thing that we would be doing, you know, to justify it. But maybe it's the fact that I have both come from, you know, that background, which is quite intense. And government isn't just, hey, let's spend everything and make sure, you know, we don't have any money at the end of the day. No, you've got to account for your numbers. So, yes, and I'm, you know, on the other side, with my experience, you know, certainly when I go into clients now, the first conversation I have is the value conversation. And it's not about we're going to go out and build, you know, data products ad nauseum. It's about, well, you know, if you've got all of these use cases, we need to attach a number to it. We need to attach an ROI. We need to attach, you know, your internal rate of return or whatever it might be. But we need to justify that. And actually, a lot of the time, it's working with the finance teams who will have models, but they may not have, you know, the models that we use, so that we kind of blend it with them and then we help them to prepare for that. And I think that's something that's changing, maybe, because, you know, it's not always, it hasn't always been there. You'll find that a lot of the times that certainly that I've observed, there are data teams that don't speak to finance. They don't even, you know, understand what's required or, you know, who the person they should be liaising with. It's one of the first things that I do if I was when I was a data leader, to go in and say, right, who's my finance contact? Who do I need to go speak to? Who do I need to sit with to model stuff out? And maybe that's also from the consulting background, you know, working for the big six. You often are, you know, especially when you're bidding for large projects, the first thing is somebody says, have you spoken to finance about that? You're like, oh, do I need to do that? But so it's kind of just one of those things that I think should be in the DNA of every single data team, is to go find their finance counterparts, go work out that value piece, get the buy-in, and then present that to the board, which is the way that you will get buy-in, because the CFO has said, hey, yes, they've worked with my team. Yes, they built the right models. We actually have invested in this time and we agree with it. You know, it's not always going to be that way, but, you know. So anyway, yeah, I've just rambled with it.
Better advice has never been given on the CDO Matters podcast. Find your financial counterpart, yes. Often in a group called FP&A, Finance Planning and Analysis, but not exclusively. Go find the person who is managing the budgets at a higher level, right? GL level stuff. Find that person and have lunch with them at least once a month. Understand what models are used, right? Is this a discounted cash flow model? Is this TCO model, ROI model? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different models. Understand how they calculate value. Understand how they view value. That is fantastic, unbelievable advice. All right.
Fundamental. Just sit with them and ask them, how do they construct a business case? What is the way that we do that? That is the fundamental aspect of what you should be doing. Sit down and just get into it. You know, forget the calculations, forget those net PV or NPV or whatever it is, because those will come. But I think it's really understanding what goes into it and how is it then looked at? How is it reviewed? How is it authorized? You know, how do you need to present it? Those are really skillful things that people should have. Okay, I'll shut up now.
No, you're bang on, because one thing you said in there is completely accurate, which is, let's assume that you actually go through this process and you have a business case and you built some sort of model to understand what the return of this investment is going to be, if that is in case the measure. And you put that in front of a CIO or you put that in front of a CEO. The first thing that person, what she or he will do, is look at the person in finance and say, have you seen this?
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
Have you seen this?
Exactly.
Or were you involved in this? And if the answer is yes, done. Right? It's done. The CEO
You've got
is not
somebody gonna, watching your back. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The CEO is not going to challenge a spreadsheet that was put together by somebody in FP&A, right? Because they're the people that they rely on to do that stuff. Yeah. All right. I do want to be mindful of time. I know you've got a hard stop, but with a few minutes, it wouldn't be a data podcast without talking about AI.
Oh,
we got to talk. We got to check the AI.
What is that?
So I'll say something slightly potentially provocative, hopefully marginally provocative, and would love to get your perspective. One of the things that I expect this year, and this is a little bit weird, and I could be completely wrong with this, by the way, of course, because I don't have any magic forward-looking goggles. I actually think we're going to hear less hype this year in the data space, meaning LinkedIn, conferences, white papers, blogs, just vendors, even arguably consultants as well. I think data leaders and CDOs are going to hear a little less about AI this year because I think that we may be floundering a little bit.
You reckon?
Yes, I think we're floundering a little bit.
Oh, and, sorry. And yes, you mean, I mean, you reckon as in you think there'll be less rhetoric around AI. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I'm surprised. I think there'll be even more.
Okay.
I think there'll be, look, I don't think it's going to stop. This train is not going to stop. Yes, I think what you're talking about is the fact that there's the realization that from a data perspective, people are going to have to pick up their game a little bit. And there's going to have to be more of those value-based conversations. And there's going to have to be more of a view on, listen, you've been in, you know, enroll for XYZ. Why isn't our data ready for the AI, you know, to be consumed and to build our models and, you know, to have the impact that we need, given that, yes, okay, structured data versus, you know, unstructured data and what LLMs use and so on and so forth. There's all those conversations, but I think we're going to have more. Look, agentic AI is on the map this year, right? Everybody's talking about it. Causal AI is now going to come into play. Analytical AI is, you know, what we used to do, you know, now is being rebranded. So I somehow think we're still going to be speaking about AI. Yes, I think what will happen is the data conversation will come up a little bit further. And I think to come back to what you said way earlier, which is it will be focused on a governance piece from a data and an AI perspective. But it needs to be linked with the ethics, the values, and the, you know, when I say values, I mean the values of, you know, the company, the DNA of the company, and of course the value piece that we've talked about. But so I think those that thing will, you know, the governance piece will drive a little bit more conversations. But it can't be we're going to be doing a governance program for the next 2 years, and we're just going to be doing it in isolation. It can't be done that way. It can't be. It's got to be a use case driven view of how we absolutely drive out the basis of where we're going to put our models, how we're going to be transparent with them, what's the ethical use, how is it going to impact people, you know, are we doing right by society, and so on and so forth. And then on the other side, is our data good? Do we know where it came from? Has it got any bias in it? You know, XYZ. So those are the things which I think will come to the fore. But I reckon we'll still be talking about AI ad nauseum as ever, because no one's going to shut up about that.
Yeah, fair enough. I could be completely wrong. And maybe I'm taking a little bit of a glass half full or glass half empty perspective instead of the glass half full perspective. And
so why do you think that we're going to stop talking
about
it?
Because
I'm interested.
I think that metaphorically speaking, customers came to the data store looking for AI, right? And I'm in the store and I'm walking around the data store. I'm looking for AI and there's nothing on the shelf. And then when I talk to the storekeeper says, sorry, not in stock yet, right? And I think those customers said, oh, okay, that's unfortunate. And then they went and bought it themselves or built it themselves.
Right.
They went and subscribed to ChatGPT through their individual credit cards and expensing a ChatGPT subscription monthly through their credit card and expensing it back. And people in HR are doing it. People in marketing are doing it. People in engineering are most certainly doing it. People in procurement are doing it. People are going, they went and got their own solution.
Right.
And I think that those people have stopped going to the AI store. They've even stopped asking the shopkeeper when the AI products be in stock, and they're just going and figuring it all out on their own. Maybe that will change, and I hope it will change, because what that storekeeper, by the way, this is you people, this is CDOs, data leaders, what you should be doing is sitting down with those people who are subscribing to ChatGPT, right? And ask them, how are you using this? What are you doing? What value are you getting? Mm-hmm. Help me understand the productivity increases. Where is it good? Where is it bad? Yep. And finding ways to plug yourself into those, what we could otherwise call shadow IT deployments of Gen AI.
Yep. Yeah.
Because they're not happening in the shadows. They're happening in broad daylight.
I agree with that. And I think there was a very recent study, which I'm just going to pull up because I'm actually talking about this in a just after this, I'm doing a prep for a webinar.
Oh, good. Killing two people.
I believe that we still have this issue that hasn't been talked about enough, or certainly should be talked about, which is that Gartner said 61% of organizations have assigned AI accountability. Oh, did you lose me?
No, we're still Malcolm? Here. Yes, we're here. We're here. Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. Here. Did you hear that?
61%.
Yeah, that's 60. So we were talking about, yeah. So you know, 61% of organizations will put AI's accountability on the CIO. So you know, what does that mean? We haven't talked about what that means for the CDO, for the those data leaders, for the CDO. What's going to happen or less functional, and how does the leadership then view the CDO, and is the CIO going to be the one that's going to be leading on this?
Maybe.
And the CDO is just going to be a data governance program.
Well, perhaps. Well, it looks like.
What is it?
Good question. But our tech is failing us, ironically, at the end of our discussion. But I do need to let you go because I know
it is. It is, which is bizarre because I'm looking at it thinking, how can it? Yes, yes.
I need to let you go because you've got a hard stop. This conversation is ending on a little bit of a low note because of our challenges related to tech. But thank you so much, Samir.
Challenges.
Indeed. If you have not checked out the Data Strategy Show, you need to check out the Data Strategy Show. If you're looking for a data consultant, you will do no better than my friend, Samir Sharma. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Safe travels to Chicago, and we will be in touch soon. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of CDO Matters. Check out another episode in another 2 weeks. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.
Bye-bye.